Let's go to the Lord in prayer. Father, we ask that you would bless our study today, that we would see here in this text your greatness and your power, your passion for your honor and glory, and what it looks like for man in that situation, and similarly in our own lives, to trust in you, to place our faith in your good power and your providence, and to live accordingly, because it does make a difference to have a God who is the living and true God over all creation. Lord, bless our study for your name's sake. In Jesus' name, amen. In chapter 4 of Mark Twain's book, Tom Sawyer, Tom goes to church. So I don't know how many of you have read Tom Sawyer. Maybe it's been a little while. But Tom goes to church in chapter 4. And as he's going to church, he's trying to impress the kids, of course. And they had certain guests that were there in their Sunday school class that week. The Judge Thackett, I think his name was. And he's wanting to impress the people. But they had going on at that time a certain challenge or a competition to see who could memorize some 2,000 scripture memory verses. And for those that you memorized, you got tickets. And if you could produce enough tickets, you would get a Bible. And you'd get brought up in front of the class and get presented this Bible. Well, Tom wanted the glory and honor of coming up in front of class, but he didn't care so much about the memory verses. And so what he did was he took his various trinkets and treasures that he had gained from somehow trading them to the other kids when they were whitewashing the fence for him. Right? He took their toys and he had them paint the fence. Anyway, he took some of these treasures and traded them to some of the other kids who had memorized their verses and got from them these tickets, so that when the teacher that morning asked, who's memorized all their verses, of course, Tom raises his hand and comes up and gets his Bible with all these 2,000 verses supposedly he had memorized. And Judge Thackett presents the Bible to Tom in front of the whole class, and of course, all the honors coming to Tom. And Judge asks him a question. He said, where were the two first disciples of Jesus? And he answers with this answer. He says, after pausing for a little bit, David and Goliath. And of course, it wasn't David and Goliath, in case you weren't quite sure of that. But just to go to show just how popular a story this is, that even the likes of Tom Sawyer, he even has heard of these two, David and Goliath. And that's the story we come to today. This is the kind of story that you won't find a children's Bible that will leave out. And yet there's such a danger with kind of broad familiarity that we have with a story like this. As is often the case in your pared down children's versions of such a story, the main point of the text is missed. And yet that's the main point, or that's the point that we've sort of grown up hearing, is the stuff that comes in the children's books. And so we're not so concerned about highlighting David's courage. We're certainly not concerned about some moralistic lesson about self-esteem or courageously facing your giants in your life. Instead, what we want to see highlighted in this story is David's concern for the honor of God, and his confidence that this concern for God's honor is also God's own concern. And because God cares about his honor, and the giant, of course, is taunting the armies of the Lord and bringing this reproach upon the Lord, that David was sure that he could count on God acting to defend his name. And this was what gave the confidence to David, was the priority of the honor and the glory of God's name. This is the reason for David's courage. It wasn't just about his self-confidence and self-esteem and how we need to emulate these things. This was not about the power of overcoming giants in our own lives by our own sheer strength of will. It was not about you being able to somehow do whatever you put your mind to doing and becoming whatever you want to become with your life. This was about faith in God, the kind of faith that's bold enough to direct your heart and life accordingly. And so what we want to do is see how this faith works itself out, a faith which doesn't rest on swords and spears, the strength of man. But instead, we want to see how the Lord blesses a kind of faith that trusts in him, that aligns itself with the Lord's purposes. And we'll do this in three parts. We'll look first of all at verses 1 through 25, this facing of a desperate situation for the Israelites here in chapter 17 of 1 Samuel. If you'll turn there with me, we'll read verses 1 through 11 first. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Socah, which belongs to Judah, and they camped between Socah and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and camped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. The Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, while Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with the valley between them. And then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. He also had bronze greaves on his legs and a bronze javelin slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and the head of his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. His shield carrier also walked before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, "Why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us." Again, the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. The Philistines were trying to take control of this valley of Elah here. It was the point of entry between their homeland and that of Saul, and it also would give them access to some of the fertile lowland below for planting crops. And so they entered the territory of Judah, it says. I think it's in verse 1 there. They entered into Judah's territory. They were the aggressors here. And so, of course, the Israelite army had to come to defend their territory. And so you had each army encamped on either side of this valley, approximately 2 miles apart from one another. And the Philistines then sent forth their champion, Goliath of Gath, a giant measuring, it says here, 6 cubits in a span, and a cubit being the measurement from the elbow to the tip of the finger, and a span from, I don't know if it's my hand or Goliath's hand, but a span from here to here, from the end of the pinky to the thumb. And so it measures about 9.5 feet. This is how big this guy was. Their armor and the weaponry are seen in verses 5 through 7. He's described as wearing this bronze armor from head down to his lower legs. The scale armor alone weighed, it says, 5,000 shekels, which equates to 126 pounds, if you can imagine wearing that much armor. The bronze javelin, or the translation here, might also just be a sort of sword. It was slung over his shoulders with a spear, its shaft as thick as a weaver's beam. If you can imagine the loom a weaver would use with the beams on the top and the bottom that they would string the lines through and then weave. So these are pretty thick beams, probably 2 or 3 inches in diameter. The iron spearhead weighing some 15 pounds, and out in front of him, which I don't know, strange to me, but out in front of him would be an additional soldier, which would carry this large shield just to provide some additional protection. And here he is in open contempt against the armies of the Lord, against the ranks of Israel, it says here. He challenged them, "Send out one man. We'll fight one-on-one and winner take all." And he did this for 40 days, threats and taunts against Israel's army in verse 16. So understandably then, the Israelites, it says in verse 11, were dismayed and greatly afraid. Not only was the Philistine army a more sophisticated and more powerful army than theirs, their champion fighter had them completely intimidated. Humanly, this would be impossible for them to prevail against this man. His bold words only made things even more terrifying for the army. And there, in verse 12 then, we see David. David, verse 12, was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse. And he had 8 sons, and Jesse was old in the days of Saul, advanced in years among men. The three older sons of Jesse had gone after Saul to the battle, and the names of his three sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and the second to him, Abinadab, and the third, Shammah. David was the youngest, and now the three oldest followed Saul. But David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's flock at Bethlehem. The Philistine came forward morning and evening for 40 days and took his stand. And then Jesse said to David his son, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this roasted grain and these 10 loaves, and run to the camp to your brothers. Bring also these 10 cuts of cheese to the commander of their 1,000, and look into the welfare of your brothers, and bring back news of them." For Saul and they all the men of Israel are in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. So David arose early in the morning and left the flock with a keeper and took the supplies and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the circle of the camp while the army was going out in battle array, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines drew up in battle array, army against army. And then David left his baggage in the care of the baggage keeper and ran to the battle line and entered in order to greet his brothers. As he was talking with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath, named Goliath, was coming up from the army of the Philistines, and he spoke these same words, and David heard them. When all the men of Israel saw the man, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. And then the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who is coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel. And it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." This is the sense of making him exempt from having to pay taxes or any other obligations to the king. And so here you have the three eldest brothers of David who are in Saul's army. And apparently David, in verse 15 here, had been going back and forth some 10 miles for some time between serving Saul as his armor bearer, as we saw in chapter 16, verse 21, or his court musician, and then tending his father's sheep. We see that in verse 15. He's going back and forth between the two, and Jesse had sent him back again here to bring food to his brothers and to check on them. So David got up early in the morning and went out to visit his brothers, and he arrived just in time to see what was going on. And there he found his brothers, and as he was greeting them, he heard the giant begin again to taunt the army of the Lord. Boy, what about this timing here? This isn't just by chance that David arrives on the scene this way, is it? David didn't just happen to show up at the right time, and Goliath didn't just happen to talk this one too many times. You see, God was providentially orchestrating the events here, all the way from the seemingly common, normal daily activities you find in verses 12 and following here about cheese and crackers and stuff. And this was all being put together by the Lord. He was preparing David for this dramatic debut into Israel's national conscience. And here was David witnessing what was going on, witnessing this army being taunted that belongs to his Lord. And he also witnessed another thing: the terror which had come over the army of Israel. And this notwithstanding the rumors circulating about how much the king would give up in order to bless this soldier who would finally take a stand against this giant. And so you have this terrible, desperate situation, one apparently hopeless for the people of God. The question is, how do we look at such a situation in our own lives? How were they to look at this, though? What kind of perspective should they have seen and interpreted this giant, so to speak? And they need to have God's perspective. They need to hold to a divine perspective, as did David, as we'll see here beginning in verse 26 for our second point here. Verses 26 to 30, if you'll follow along. "And David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, 'What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?' The people answered him in accord with this word, saying, 'Thus it will be done for the man who kills him.' Now Eliab, the oldest brother heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger burned against David. And he said, "Why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle." But David said, "What have I done now? Was it not just a question?" And then he turned away from him to another and said the same thing, and the people answered the same thing as before. David had a much bigger perspective on this situation than did the rest of the army of Israel. The rest saw an unbeatable bronze giant, all including the impressive guy out in front carrying his shield. What they heard was the taunt of one mighty army against their own, a much weaker army. What they felt was doom and gloom, but what David saw was something very different. He saw not an unbeatable giant, but an uncircumcised Philistine. He heard not the taunts against their army, but against the army of the living God. And what he felt was jealousy for God's name. This is just another application of what we saw in chapter 16, verse 7, where the Lord said to Samuel with regard to Eliab, he said, "Take no notice of his appearance or tall stature." There, it was with reference to his appointing the next king, that God doesn't look upon the external things. But here, it's about looking at the externals even with regard to an enemy. God's not overcome by the strength of even a Goliath like this. And David saw right past the externals. He just started peppering the soldiers with questions. In verse 26, and by the way, this is the first time David speaks in the Bible. And his words are very important here. He just starts peppering the soldiers with questions. "Did you see this man? Did anybody else hear what he was saying? Who does this uncircumcised giant think that he is? That he would taunt the Lord's army? What did the king say he would do for the one who defeats this giant and removes this reproach from Israel? Are we going to let him just keep mocking the army of the Lord like this?" Questions, 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 stirring up the people. And his brother, of course, Eliab overhears these things. His little brother over in the corner here talking this way. And Eliab was annoyed with him. In verse 28, "What do you think you're doing here? You only want to come here to see the battle. You're just trying to entertain yourself. Why don't you go back to your little sheepies? Why don't you leave men's work to real men here and go back and go take care of mom and pop?" You remember, it was Eliab whose appearance was so impressive to Samuel as David's brothers were being brought one before another. And this one was the first one, you remember? And Samuel thought, "Wow, look at him. Just like Saul, taller and better looking than the rest. This has got to be the king." And God says, "No, I've rejected him. I'm looking for something else, not just taller stature and better looks. I don't want just physical appearance here." And so here you have Eliab annoyed with David. David responded to his brother, "What? I'm just asking a question." You can almost read into the background of this interchange between brother and brother, right? This younger brother speaking back to his older brother. "Just leave me alone. You don't got to tease me or pick on me again," right? And so he just turns away, disregards his older brother, and turns to others. See, David didn't wake up that day expecting to get into a fight with a Philistine giant. Right? He went on a mission, and he was willing to do, though, whatever would come up that the Lord would bring across his path in order to fight for his Lord's honor. In this sort of boldness here, The speaking about what David was doing and the kind of talk and questions that he was asking, this word traveled fast, and King Saul heard about David's talk as well in verse 31. If you want to read there, "When the words which David spoke were heard, they told these things to Saul, and so he sent for David. And David responded, 'Let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with this giant. Don't be afraid. I'll go fight.'" And of course, Saul replies in verse 33, "What are you going to do? You're still so inexperienced, yet he's been fighting since he was your age. You don't stand a chance. What are you doing, David?" And of course, David gives his answer in verses 34 to 37. David said to Saul, Your servant was tending his father's sheep when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, and I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard, probably talking about the lion and his mane, and I struck him and I killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine, he's going to be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God. And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and may the Lord be with you." "I may be inexperienced as a soldier," David says, "but I have experience. Saul, have you ever wrestled a lion or a bear?" Right? This isn't insignificant. I'm going to do the same thing to this uncircumcised Philistine here. And notice, in reflecting upon his own past experiences this way, where he puts the glory, where he acknowledges the strength has come from in verse 37. "It was the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the bear. He will deliver me again, even now, from the hand of this Philistine." He recognized that his success was not due to his skill or strength. It's not just that he was bigger and stronger than a bear. He recognized that it wasn't about his slingshots and his arrows. It wasn't about those things. His success came specifically from the Lord. And if the Lord had helped him in the past, this is again such a good reminder to us. If we can reflect upon how the Lord has been faithful in the past, it gives us such confidence and trust to know that he will continue to be faithful in the future. This kind of trust in God's power and past help is what gives David confidence this time too. He had no question about God's ability to save. And so notice also his reason for confidence. It didn't stop just with an understanding of God's power. He was also confident because in verse 36 he recognized what was at stake here. He says, because the Philistine had taunted the armies of the living God. God doesn't like it when people taunt him. That's what David felt like here. He knew that God cares about the glory of his name. And that when his name is dishonored, it is good reason to expect that God will work to rectify the situation, to somehow make his name great again. And so on the battlefield, how'd that work out? Not just in this case, but in times past. When you're the army of the Lord and the other army mocks your God in the name of their own gods, and then they parade their military strength around as if it made them invincible, and then you have the perspective of David as one of the Lord's army, you see this as a sure reason to hope that God would actually give you the victory, right? They're taunting the armies of the Lord. I don't care how big their army is. I trust that the Lord fights for his honor. In our own lives, you think about how senseless it looks to go on into the mission field, into some place where you have just so little, even language barriers and other factors, and yet you go in anyway. In evangelism, you see people just mock the Lord and have such disdain for his name, and you realize the Lord loves to save in such situations. He's powerful. His grace is, it itself is without limitations to its power. They're mocking God, but God loves to work powerfully in such situations for the glory of his name. You think about Christian families and the rebellion that goes on in some of the situations with children and even with a spouse who's just so dug in. And you think, Lord, it's hopeless. It's hopeless. And yet God's honor is at stake with these things. He loves to see people saved, and he loves to be glorified and praised when his power is on display. We're not fighting Philistines, but we are at work according to God's purposes and in doing the Lord's work in the world through the gospel. We can have confidence. The Lord is powerful to save. And so David, he sees these things and he's unfazed by the apparent odds. He knew that God delights to work powerfully for his people who depend on him. He knew that God works even through the little guy. He works through the simple and through the despised in the eyes of the world. And so here he is, this young man, bold and confident with his confidence in the Lord. And of course, Saul didn't need much convincing. If David wanted to risk his life, he says, go for it, right? May God be with you. And so here brings us to our third point then, verses 38 and following. This response then, as David has this right perspective on the troubling situation, he responds then in this dependent faith. Verse 38 to 40. Saul clothed David then with his garments and put a bronze helmet on his head, and he clothed him with armor. And David girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. So David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. And David took them off. And he took his stick in his hand and chose for himself five smooth stones from the brook and put them in the shepherd's bag, which he had, even his pouch. And his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. Saul still didn't get it. He was still leaning on the strength of armor to win his battle. And so here's this bold young man, and he's trying to fit him with the armor. And of course, it didn't work for David. He threw this armor back off and said, I don't need this stuff. And he goes down into the riverbed instead, this little brook, and picks up these five stones and puts them into his pouch. And then with sling in hand, he quickly approaches the Philistine. So simple. The narrative as it traces David's movements here is so brief and concise over against Goliath, which is sort of longer and slower. I don't know if it's due to the just narrative and literature-wise, if it's due to the weight and size of this big giant over compared to this small little Israelite who's able to just sort of maneuver quickly, decide quickly, and act decisively. I know David doesn't really seem to hesitate here. Remember Jonathan in chapter 14, who doesn't tell his father what he's about to do and runs up the hill to fight against the Philistine. Very similar situation there with him. Just trust the Lord. I know the Lord is able to save. I'm not sure if he will. He's sovereign. It's his will. But what do you say, armor bearer? You want to go with me? Let's go fight. That's David's mindset. He trusts in the Lord. He doesn't lean on numbers and horses and swords. He just says, Lord, will you bless us? So here is David rushing out to face the Philistine. And when Goliath saw David, he was stunned. Verse 41. The Philistine came on and approached David with the shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him. For he was but a youth and ruddy, with a handsome appearance. And the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you would come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine also said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and to the beasts of the field. Is this the best that you guys can do, is sending him? Interesting, this disdain. He's looking down on David, both metaphorically and literally, right? Looking down. Are you going to chase me around this way like as a dog with stick? And he started cursing David, looking to his own gods, probably these Canaan deities, to Dagon or whatever else, assuming that these gods will help him in this situation, bringing curses down on David by these fake gods that he worships. David was unimpressed, verse 45. David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. Goliath was relying on the wrong thing. David knew it. He was relying on sword and spear and javelin. When you're doing business with the Lord, whether you're on his side and looking for a king, or whether you're against him and trying to fight his armies, God simply is not impressed by external measures. That's the lesson we've seen now a number of chapters here, isn't it? God doesn't see on the outside. And here David had that perspective. He looked right past the shields and the armors and the swords. Never in world history has an army prevailed in war which God did not ordain. Do you believe that? Do you believe that he is sovereign over all? Never was God dependent on the size of an army by its tanks or battle armor to secure its victory. Never. It doesn't mean he doesn't utilize those things, but always God is in charge. And David knew that. And so he came in the name of the Lord of hosts. He says, I fight by the strength of the Lord and in his name. And this gave David all the confidence in the world. Not self-confidence. This wasn't about him just having a high self-esteem. This wasn't the power of positive thinking. Good luck with that. Go face a Goliath and see how that'll get you. This was one man seen with the eyes of faith. What were God's purposes? To honor his name. The name of the one whom you have taunted, David said to Goliath. You've taunted the Lord. And David knew that God did not tolerate this sort of thing well, his name being dishonored this way. And he saw it as a sure recipe for his own victory. And that's what gave him the confidence to just risk his life. He didn't feel like it was a big old risk here, did he? Again, Jonathan comes to mind. And he says, Lord, will you do this for us? If they say this, then yes. And he just goes and does it, just trusting God to provide and to protect and to fight for him. Listen to the confidence of David here in verses 46 and 47. As he continues on toward the giant, this day the Lord will deliver you up into my hands. And I will strike you down and remove your head from you. And I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth. He takes the giant's language and turns it back on him. That all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear. For the battle is the Lord's. And he will give you into our hands. The Lord will deliver you into my hands. And then I'm going to strike you down and feed you to the birds, just like you thought you were going to do to me. And interesting, he gives the reason. He gives the reason in verse 47, two parts. And both of these reasons that he gives refer back to this commitment of the Lord to his own honor, don't they? To his own glory, to the reputation of his name. That all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, the only true God. And you contrast this with the gods of the Philistines and the Canaanites. This is the true God. And I want him to fight in this kind of situation for me when all the odds are stacked against me. I want everything to look like the favor is on the other side so that when we win, God gets the glory. And of course, we're not here fighting battles against Coeur d'Alene or Rathdrum or something, but we are fighting a spiritual battle, a battle for people's minds and hearts, a battle for the gospel. We want to see it progress in the world and see people come to honor and worship the Lord. And we do this against all odds. We fight all kinds of worldviews, systems against God and a rebelliousness of the heart. We fight all sorts of agenda and media and all these things. And yet, you know what? The Lord is powerful to save. And we want to go forward with confidence. Why? Because we know that there is a God who does these things, who fights for his people. He goes on, I want all the world to know on the one hand, and I want all this assembly on the other. The assembly includes more than Israel here. It includes the Philistines as well. That all this assembly may know that the Lord doesn't depend on sword or spear. He doesn't need the strength of man's power to accomplish his purposes. He brings deliverance and salvation his own way by his power. The battle belongs to the Lord, verse 47. And God is passionate for his glory like this. He fights for it. He rules all of history according to this purpose and goal. This is his chief aim, is to see himself glorified. And so that is definitely the side of the battle we want to be on in this life, isn't it? When we're fighting for the glory and honor of the Lord according to his purposes, doing his work his way, we're guaranteed victory. Maybe not in every situation. We might lose a little skirmish here and there, so to speak. But even that fits into God's overarching plan. And all of these things work together for his ultimate victory.
And so we're guaranteed victory, and we can go forward with this kind of confidence because the battle belongs to the Lord. What did Moses say to the people as they left Egypt in Exodus 14, 13? Do not fear. Pharaoh and his armies chasing them down. Don't fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. Or Isaiah 41, verse 10. Do not fear, for I am with you. Do not anxiously look around you, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Surely I will help you. Surely I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. There's nothing to fear. So what does David do? He goes running into the middle of the battle. Verse 48, to the end of the section here, verse 54. Then it happened when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. Don't you love that? Just runs there. And David put his hand into his bag and took from it a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. And the stone sank into his forehead so that he fell on his face to the ground. And thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. And he struck the Philistine and killed him, but there was no sword in David's hand. And so David then ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. The men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the slain Philistines lay along the way to Sharaim and even to Gath and Ekron. The sons of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundered their camps. Then David took the Philistine's head and brought it up to Jerusalem. But he put his own weapons in his tent. The sling, there is actually evidence throughout ancient literature and art that the sling was actually a common weapon used in warfare. Even in Judges chapter 20, verse 16, it talks about a whole bunch of these left-handed slingshot throwers and how successful they were. They could hit a hare without missing it, it says. A skilled warrior could throw a stone with his sling some 100 to 150 miles per hour. These stones were typically, so I think of a slingshot, and I think of little pebbles like this, but these were 2 to 3 inches in diameter. And some, in the museum, there were some pictures online of some of these stones that they dug up and have them in a museum over in Britain. And they're about the size of a small lemon. These are what are moving through the air at a speed like that. And so here's David running quickly toward this much heavier and slower Philistine, and he quickly throws his stone, hits the target, the bullseye. So it's a one round, first round knockout. And this is probably the only part of his body that he could have really hit with this kind of success. It was the only part not covered with armor. He killed his enemy. Right? This is without any sort of dependence upon sword. Even the language here, there was no sword in David's hand in verse 50. This is to make the point, he didn't depend upon the things that everybody else thought he would need. All he had was a stone and a slingshot. But even his success with the sling, it's not what ultimately gave him success. The Lord's battle is always to be fought God's way. And as Zechariah says, chapter 4, verse 6, it's not by might nor by power, but by what? By the Spirit. By the Spirit. So the Philistine army was defeated. They scattered and fled in the directions toward home. And the Israelites chased them down and cut them down along the way. David, interestingly here, takes the Philistine head back to Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is actually, at this point, not in Israel's hands. It's actually a Philistine city. So he's taking this trophy of their champion's head back to just walk out in front of their walls. I'm not sure how it went. It doesn't describe it here, but he takes then the weapons, presumably it's Goliath's weapons, back to his own tent. David had the right perspective in all this, didn't he? He trusted in the Lord and for the right reasons. He actually believed that it meant something to be a servant of the living God, to fight on the side of the Lord. He thought that that fact, that he served the true God over against these fake pagan gods like Goliath served, should mean something. That it would actually play into how things would come out in the end. He believed that if God had identified with Israel, that he would fight for his people, for his own name's sake. And these facts gave David such a confidence that he was able to go boldly this way, even before a Goliath like this. And so how much more we're joined to his own son, to God's own son, doing God's purposes, presumably, according to his word and for his glory. What is it that drives us? What is it that stirs our passions? Is it the honor and glory of God? Or is it our own comfort and ease? Is it our own entertainment or preferences? What is it that makes us who we are? What is it that determines how we spend our time? When we see honor, the honor of God just trashed or thrown in the mud, do we rise up? Do we care? We have no reason to fear man. No reason to worry about protecting ourselves, our reputation. No reason to live for our own peace and prosperity. And yet I fear if we were to look at each one of us and evaluate the thoughts of our hearts, it might be hard to tell in some cases that we actually serve a living God. Does it really make a difference in our lives? What's determining our choices and our passions? God is on our side. And he has given us such a purpose to live for. And the power to actually accomplish those purposes. Father in heaven, give us this passion for the honor of your name in order to live for it. We know that you care about your honor and that you fight for it. And so we can trust you with all that we have in life for your honor and glory. And because of Jesus, in whose name we pray, amen.